Today is Friday, August 11th, 2006. I am Sandy Fahler, an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today, I'm interviewing Dorothy Kleinfelter, who retired after 37 and a half years of service with emeritus status from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 2001 as Associate Dean of the School of Education. Hello, Dorothy.
Hello.
The first questions I'm going to ask you have to do with your early life, where you were born, when you were born. Talk about your family. Did you have any brothers and sisters? What your parents did, where you went to elementary school, high school, anybody, any teachers or anyone that were mentors for you?
Okay, that's a big... I was born October 23rd, 1940, right before the war started. And the war, of course, impacted my early life. I was born in Waukesha, Wisconsin, and my dad was a construction worker, operated one of these big cranes. So he did war work, and we had a little trailer, and we moved around. We went to Hanford, Washington, and he worked on dredging the Columbia River there for the plutonium plant for the war. Of course, they didn't know what they were doing, but he worked for DuPont out there, and then he went to Indiana and worked down there for war work. And then after the war, we came back to Wisconsin. Lived in Milwaukee in a trailer because you couldn't get housing at that time. And in 1948, Dad bought a house in Waukesha, in the country, outside of Waukesha. And so I went to a Calhoun grade school there, and then went to Waukesha High and graduated in 1958.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
And I had one brother, a brother 2.5 years younger than me, Gerald. And we had really a great childhood. We lived on this little 2-acre farm and farmette, so to speak. And we did a lot of garden work. We sold raspberries, sold asparagus, you know, picked strawberries till my back ached. And there was no shortage of things to do.
Any animals?
We had a couple pigs, and we had some chickens. Yeah, we had chickens. We even gave them names. And when we ate Lady Buff Orpington, it was a very sad day. But, you know, both of my parents had strictly farming backgrounds. And so for me, this little bit of kind of truck gardening was really nice. Because I got, you might say, transferred some of their knowledge to me, the next generation. So that was nice.
Do you think it was a good school system?
We had an excellent school system. Calhoun School was run by a principal. Miss Coltis was her name. And she was just a strict and sharp, and the teachers were good, with one exception. I didn't like one teacher. And high school, I think we had a great school. Waukesha High at that time was known as a very good high school.
Mm-hmm.
That was before it split into South Waukesha and North High School and so forth. And, you know, I did well in school. I was always a very serious student. I guess that's how I'd characterize myself, serious. Everything was important, you know. I was not a happy-go-lucky kid. I worked hard, and my parents worked hard, and my mother had been a teacher for about 4 years before she got married, but then she was a housewife, so she just took care of us all. And my dad was a construction man, operated a crane, and he worked for some of the big companies in Milwaukee, digging some of those big sewer ditches, you know, and then they ended up digging tunnels. They would tunnel down under the ground, and those big combination septic storm sewers that they're now having troubles with, you know, in Milwaukee. But he always had good work. People in his field usually were off in the winter because construction stopped, but he worked year-round. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that I remember of my childhood. We never got a vacation. Mm-hmm. All my friends were, you know, going to Florida for a week or going out to Yellowstone for a week. We never took a vacation. Mm-hmm. We just worked all the time.
Yeah.
And when Dad would have 1 week off where maybe they were switching over machines or something, he'd paint the house. I mean, we didn't go anywhere. My grandparents, I had one set that lived in Aurora, Illinois, and one set that lived in Rock Springs near Reedsburg, Wisconsin. So we would alternate, you know, we would drive. 1 month we'd go here, next month we'd go there. We did a lot of visiting with our grandparents till they died in the 50s, and that ended, of course. Mm-hmm. But
did your parents assume that you were going to go to college?
No. College was not, no one in our family ever went to college. My mother had gone to 2 years of, what did they call it? And, you know, state teachers, state.
Normal school?
Normal school, that was what she did. That mm-hmm. was the word. And she was proud of that. And she was very, both of my parents were very bright, I think. You know, and my dad never completed high school. He was a really hard luck story. He was a Pennsylvania German. His family left Pennsylvania in 1911 and came to Illinois. And they were poor. They never owned anything. They rented off farms and just did hard farm labor all the time. And my dad was needed on the farm. And he, I think about sixth grade, he was done. He didn't go to school after that. Mm-hmm. But when I was a kid, I remember him being able to do long division in his head. He would, you know, we would be learning it in school, and he would do it in his head, and we were just so impressed. Anyway, he was certainly a smart, bright man, but he just did not have formal education. Mm-hmm. So,
What did you do after high school then?
Well, then after high school, I went to college. I came.
So you knew you were going to go to college?
Well, not exactly. That's kind of a story, too. I did really well in school, and I think I graduated in, we got a class in Waukesha, 400 kids, I think, and I was third in the class. That was, and because of that, I qualified for a legislative scholarship in the state of Wisconsin, which gave me tuition for 1 year at a school of my choice in Wisconsin. Well, this was a gift from heaven, you see.
No kidding.
This was money. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I think it was $87 a semester. But my mother and dad thought, you know, well, we shouldn't waste that. So let's go to school 1 year. And it was never discussed after that. Uh-huh. I mean, before that, I had long talks with my dad, and this was never, I never had this great passion to go to school, but I had a passion to learn. I was a reader. I read everything in sight. And I love learning things. And I think my mother knew I should go to college, but my dad kept saying, no, you've been trained. I took the clerical course in Waukesha High, so I took shorthand and typing and mm-hmm. bookkeeping and all that stuff. And Dad, we'd sit down with a pencil and paper and figure out how much money I could earn in 4 years that I would be going to college instead of spending money going to college. And of course, it always came out that it was kind of foolish to go to college. We never factored in how much more you'd earn if you went to college, or how much happier your life might be. Because for me, college was the thing to do. I mean, it just opened up my world. And I came here intending to be a medical technologist.
So you came to Wisconsin?
I came to Wisconsin.
Madison. Okay.
And I lived in Liz Waters' dormitory, got in the first year, and I think it was $820 for the year's food contract, which of course I could pay some of, but then my father, but we were poor, you know, so it was a stretch, but we did, and I always remember people around me, I never learned to smoke, never took up smoking, and the reason was because I couldn't afford the 25 cents for the package of cigarettes. We'd go to this little store in the Liz Waters, you know. And I'd buy once a week a nickel popsicle, and everybody was buying these candy bars and these cigarettes and stuff. I mean, I was really tight with a dollar.
Did you work that first year?
And then I got a job. I had a business, my business school teacher, Ms. Trakel, was good friends with Russell J. Hostler here in the School of Education. He was the business education teacher. And she told me to go see him. So I went to see him the first week I was here, and he hired me to be his little secretary. And it was kind of an adventure. He was a real kind of a charming but curmudgeonly man, you know, and he wanted things the way he wanted them. And at the time, he was chairman of the Department of Education, so I was just one of the girls kind of in the big office. But then when he quit being chairman, he went way up on the fourth floor of the education building, and had his, that's where he taught his courses, and he had his office and so forth. And So then that's where I'd go after school, after I was done, 3 o'clock or so, I'd go up there and he'd have letters and I'd dictate them, or he'd dictate and I'd take the shorthand. And then he also was writing some of these books, you know, some of the shorthand books are out if you look, the old time, Greg and Hostler are the two authors.
Oh, okay.
And so Hostler would be making up these letters, you know, and I always remember he'd be trying to use unusual words that would stretch a shorthand student's memory.
Uh-huh.
Well, boy, they stretched me, too. I remember one where he was talking about the rotisserie. Return the rotisserie, you know, and this was supposed to be the word of the day. Why, I had trouble with that. And he was it was really a good experience because I learned my shorthand better. I learned how to deal with kind of a difficult professor, which was good.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to be a really good typist because he did not want a letter with an error in it. He didn't like erasures. He'd hold the letter up to the light, then you better do this over again. So that was my little job after school that I did all 4 years.
Well, what happened then after your freshman year? Did your parents, were they convinced that this was a good thing for you?
It just was never talked about. I just signed my contract for the next year. It was just assumed because I blossomed and loved it so much, you know, and it was just, it was kind of foggy to me. Why? There was never any active animosity in my going. It was just that it was kind of foolish, Dorothy, because you're just a girl and you can get a job, and because I was very employable because of my shorthand and stuff.
But do you think your mother had influence over your father?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I think it just happened. Mm-hmm. It just happened. And the scholarship, I think, was kind of the tipping point. And then, of course, I won a scholarship for the second year.
Oh.
So that also, I got the Liz Waters Hall, got $200.
Okay.
Now, this is such peanuts now, but in those days, it was a big deal.
Sure.
$200, because the second year, I think, tuition was $113 a semester. So basically, that paid tuition.
Mm-hmm.
So, got to use that.
And you started out in med tech.
I started out in med tech, and then what I really wanted to do, and what I had explored, was wildlife ecology or forestry. I was one of those girls who really wanted to be a park ranger or something, you know. So I went over to the ag school and talked with them there and learned, much to my chagrin, that it was impossible for me to get a degree in either of those fields. And the reason was because to get the degree, you had to go to this summer camp up in Biola's County that was open only to men. They had no facilities for women. So, my dear, women can't get a degree in this field, they said to me.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I, like a good little girl, meek little girl, I went and found something else. And I don't know why I settled on med tech. I guess it was a very employable field at the time. And there was a certain pressure that I needed to be able to get a job. I was not someone who was just going to take an English major or something.
Sure.
I needed to see a goal. And then we got into chemistry, and then I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll take chemistry. Well, then I hit a chemistry course where you had to know how to use a slide rule, and I did not know how. And that was just the worst thing. So I got out of chemistry. And then I, because of my business background, I thought, well, why don't I take accounting, business? Because I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
I was a good bookkeeper, And I had also, I neglected to tell you, too, that my summers, starting with the year between junior and senior in high school, I worked in the summer for Hardy Ryan Abstract Company in Waukesha. And I was, you know, I'd take in their money for their rentals, and I'd pay bills and make the deposit and take it to the bank. And then I did a lot of typing of those big, long 500-page abstracts, you know. And then I filed documents. They'd give me a list of 100 documents. I'd pull them all out in an afternoon, and the next morning they'd all be back in my basket to put back in the file. I mean, that was really a kind of a dead-end job. But I had a lot of experience in this area. So accounting was a thing. And I did well in accounting. You just zoomed through. I got into it a semester or a year late, I think. I was a year late, so I was kind of doubling up on courses. And
Were there a fair number of women in the accounting courses?
There were almost none. That was an interesting story too, because in the accounting classes, they habitually divided the alphabet A through K, and then L through Z. And the A through K had one set of teachers as they passed through the school, and the L through Z had another set. And I think to my misfortune, I don't like to speak ill of someone, but I had a man, a professor, Mr. Gibson, who was the chairman of the Department of Accounting at that time. And he might have been a great teacher, but he certainly did not know how to interact with women. And so you'd be in the class and you'd be minding your own business, and he'd say, "Well, Miss Kleinfelder, how did you do on today's problem? Would you tell us the answer?" And it was that way all the time. And if you dared to ask a question as a woman, he'd denigrate, "Well, fellas, do you think we should tell her?" You know, these kinds of things. It was really awful. I mean, nowadays people would have reported him. No. But I struggled through, but I had him for 3 classes. It was just a nightmare. So my accounting, it really wasn't happy, but, you know, I didn't know anything else. You just did it.
Yeah.
You just struggled through. And there were some wonderful people there, Bowers and Blakely and Angelins, I got to be good friends with. And
were there any female professors?
Angela Lins was the only one. But she had her own troubles, you know, in the accounting department. She was very experienced, but she never got to be chairman. You know, those were the days.
Yeah.
It just was that way. This was 58, 59, 60, 61.
Now, did you participate in any outside activities, or what was the social life like on campus?
The social life, it was very controlled. Those were the days, of course, when, you know, the dorms had strict limits and guys could come, but they had to leave by a certain date, and you could bring a guy downstairs in Liz Waters to one of the parlors, but you had to keep your feet on the floor. You know, it was really... I loved the dining room. I loved, you know, the eating together. I got exposed to foods I'd never had at home, ever. It was really a mind-opening, and I got some really good friends around the state and still in touch with some of them, and it was a mind-opening experience, really. And the dating, I didn't do a lot of dating. I mean, I had some boyfriends, but I was too busy.
Yeah. Did your brother go on to college?
Yes, my brother just went on. He came also to Wisconsin. He was 3 years behind me in school, so when I was a senior, he was a junior, a freshman.
Uh-huh.
And he was class president of his high school class and very well liked. He was a very socially just wonderful. I mean, the girls fawned over him, and he was just one of those popular, nice guys, you know. And I never made that. But anyway, I was the older sister. And he talked about how it was, he'd go into a class and they'd say, "Oh, you're Dorothy, now I suppose, are you going to be a good student?" You know, he had kind of, because I had been a really good student.
Sure.
And he had always kind of resented that he was trying to, they were holding him to my standard. But he was better than I was. He could write, he was thoughtful, he was a good guy. He is a good guy, he's a great brother.
Uh-huh.
And,
So then you graduated what year?
I graduated in June of 62.
62, okay. Then what?
Well, when I was looking for jobs, starting about January, February, the interviews came to the university. I was trained to be a public accountant. Of course, I interviewed with Anderson and all those other big ones whose names I've not forgotten. And they were more than happy to employ me, but I was informed by all of them that it would not be possible to be a full-scale auditor because the auditors had to go out on the road and stay in motels and things, and a woman couldn't do that. So I would be the office auditor, basically the clerk in the office. So I wasn't interested in that very much. I had a good offer from some brake heavy-duty equipment manufacturer in Racine, and I didn't like Racine, and that wasn't pleasing to me. So then Professor Bowers, Jim Bowers, said, "Well, have you thought about the university?" I said, "Well, I can't be a teacher." You know, when you're a student, you have no idea that there's this huge infrastructure going on behind you or under things, keeping things, running the payroll. Well, it was just a mind-blowing thing to me. And he said, I want you to go down and interview, I want you to see Reuben Lorenz. So he sent me down to see Reuben. And this was in the beautiful limestone building on the corner, the old administration building, the corner of Park and Langdon. It was a gorgeous old limestone building, built kind of like Bascom Hall. And I went up to the office there, and there was Reuben, and he was friendly and nice. And he said, well, you know, we got lots of opportunities here. Reuben was one of the guys who was ahead of his time, and he was interested in getting some professional women in the business office, because there were none. And so he walked with me around, and we went over to see Ralph Farnsworth, the head of purchasing, and he was willing to hire me. And then we went to see Ed Horton, who was head of budget. And these were in little houses. You know how, remember how the administration building was on that corner, but then mm-hmm. there were houses on those little courts back in there.
Mm-hmm.
So purchasing had one house, and budget had another house. And so Ed Horton, oh, we've got a great job here in budget. We need people. And then the third job that was available was George Everson, who at the time was head of gifts and grants. But George was on vacation, so I didn't get to meet George. But Reuben explained to me a little bit of what it was like, and it was working with the federal government and getting grants and gifts, and it was working with faculty and so forth. And of all the jobs, that one sounded the most interesting to me, so I took it. And never met George. And I took it, and it was, I think the first salary was $4.25 a month, which was big bucks to me.
And what was it? What were you called? Were you a specialist?
No, I was called an accountant one, I think, or account specialist one.
Okay.
And the rest is history. I was attracted to that, number one, because everyone had said George Everson was a nice guy, which he turned out to be. He was... I'd have to say George is really my mentor in the university. He was great. And I learned a lot from him, and I tried to emulate him, you know, because he was such a service-oriented guy and interested and hustled and never turned anyone away. He was just a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
He died too young. But... Gifts. I liked gifts and grants. It appealed to me because it was new, and at the time, gifts and grants in 1962, every file that we had could go in one five drawer file cabinet. You know, that was the grant itself, the proposal, and the financial reports related to it. Well, in 1962 is when the federal government, started really throwing bucks into science. NIH and NSF just exploded. Well, so did our grants. And we just were inundated. I mean, they hired me, and then the next year they hired Marita, and they hired Bob Erickson, and the next year they hired a couple more people. I mean, we were just expanding all the time. And but my office was next door in this little old two-story house with dormers,
mm-hmm.
435 North Park Street. Great little house, and we took the whole building, and my office was back in the back thing in the sunny side of the house under a dormer. And if I'd stand up really fast, I'd hit my head on the dormer top. You know, you had to kind of move your chair back and then stand up. No air conditioning, nothing like that, you know. We sweltered there.
But you had an office.
But I had an office. There was another woman with me. The secretary was in the office with me, Wilma Shams, and she was a great kind of a She was from the Boston area and a real, kind of a tough cookie, but a realist, you know. I mean, and she too, I learned so much from her. These were types of people I had never run into before.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I was the first person, and Reuben Lorenz, of course, worked with Neil Cafferty. Neil Cafferty was the vice president for finance, and he had the big office next door. And Reuben then had an office next to him. And technically I was working for Neil Cafferty. And then, of course, when the Peterson Building got built, then Neil Cafferty went up to Van Hise sometime in there. And then he died also. But he, Then Reuben became the vice president. But Gifts and Grants was an exciting place to be. There was things to adjust to and new regulations, and we were making policies, you know. We were, new things came up and there was no one to tell us. And George was a wonderful man, and he would listen to people, and he listened to us. I mean, I felt I could talk to him, just, you know, make suggestions, and he trusted us, delegated to us, you know. It wasn't a micromanaged office at all, and it was a very good work experience.
And you stayed how many years there then?
Well, I stayed till 1970, so that was 8 years.
Oh.
So it wasn't all that long, but yet it was. But in those 8 years, we moved from that little house, we moved to the Peterson Building, when everything got kind of more professional and bigger. And then, of course, we lived through the wonderful, exhilarating, horrible times of all of the National Guard and the unfortunately, our office was kind of a focal point of some of that. And I ended up kind of being a focal point, not through anything I did, but remember those like Paul Soglin was one of them, but then there was Jim Rowan. And then they always had the CBS cameras around, you know. And I remember one time Jim Rowan came into my office, came into Research Admin, got off the elevator, the camera was with him, came up to the front desk, wanted to know who had the classified contracts. Well, the secretary, of course, didn't know, and so she directed him to me because I was kind of the proposal person at that time. And so Enie walks into my office, and Bob Atwell was with him, who was assistant chancellor, I think. Bob Atwell went on, he left the university years later, went on to be head of the Council of American Education for years and years and years. He was respected. But I remember he was a tall drink of water, and he had this camel, really beautiful camel coat on, you know. And there was he and the cameraman and Jim Rowan. And Jim Rowan came up to my office, my desk, and stood up and took his finger like this and just went, "We want to know where the classified contracts are." Pounded on my desk. And of course, I was sitting there, and all the files were behind me, a bank of files on the wall, and I said, "We don't have any," which was true. The university at that time had no classified contracts, although you couldn't make anybody believe that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that went on, and then just a little while, and then finally I think George Everson about that time came in, and it kind of broke up. But that was the first encounter, and I remember being kind of intimidated and really kind of angry at the guy, because he wasn't rude, but he was really belligerent. And I always kind of faulted Bob Atwell. I thought he was there on behalf of the university. He should have set foot. He kind of just observed. And so, you know, and then of course we lived through the National Guard surrounding the building, and then we lived through the sit-in in the lobby of the Peterson Building. Probably 200 people lived there for about a week.
Now, what year was that, do you remember?
Oh, I don't remember. It was like 68 or somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived there. And I remember I happened to be down in that lobby going in or something at a time when one of those windows to the registrar's office was broken. And I always remember it was quite thick glass. And it was broken about eye level. Someone just really hit it hard. But then the top half of the window just slid down like a guillotine. And I thought, man, you know, this had the potential for killing people. And it was a very bad situation. And then the humorous part was that, you know, we'd come into work and here'd be mothers nursing their babies, and which was a new thing for me to see. Those were very conservative times.
Sure.
And the whole place, we joked, it smelled like a goat farm, you know? I mean, it was the worst odor you ever saw that we would walk through to get to work. It was, but mercifully it was over. And they swabbed the place out and we went on. But it was, those were interesting times.
Well, what made you leave the research admin?
What made me leave? George Everson became the business manager. And I was kind of next. I had been assistant director. And they passed me over. Len Van Ness was instrumental in this. And they passed me over and hired and appointed Bob Erickson as director. And I will admit to being a little chagrined. And then I thought, you know, I don't want to work here forever. It was also time. I had learned everything. I had done a lot. I had helped develop a computer system, which I'm very proud of to this day, and it's still operating at the university, the External Support Information System, and I don't think you can say that about too many programs. But I was kind of burned out on research admin. I had handled enough accounting ledgers and enough proposals, and so I started looking around, and one of the professors I had been working with in subcontracts, remember Vern Sumi and mm-hmm. Reed Bryson? They were involved in the satellites and the spin scans camera that interesting professors that I had worked with and apparently done work that he liked. We had worked quite closely on developing this subcontract to make this camera. And I had worked with him. It was Reed Bryson. And Reed was involved at that time working on the campus trying to get the Institute for Environmental Studies going. And they had finally gotten the faculty, senate, and the administration to approve the establishment of the institute effective July 1 of 1970. So then Reed had a little budget that was going to be effective July 1 because of the approval he had gotten the money, and then he needed a staff. So he came and asked me if I'd be interested in working for the institute. And at that time, he had also hired Eric Rudy, who was an associate dean, and Eric was going to work half-time as an associate director of the institute. And Eric, I knew Eric very well from my research admin stuff. So anyway, the two of them kind of put the pressure on me, and I accepted. And the rest is history again. I loved my time in IES. And again, I guess I'm good at or get a thrill out of new things. See, research admin was kind of new. It was originally called gifts and grants, but we changed the name to research administration financial. And then IES, of course, was everything. They had no payroll, they had no accounts, they had no personnel records. Everyone had to be hired. We went through all the tenure battles in the 70s trying to get a professor tenured in IES, which was not a traditional school or college, you know, and they were very interesting political times and interesting people. Ed Young was the chancellor, and Bob Borchers was the vice chancellor. And
now, were you in Science Hall at that time?
No, our offices started out in the meteorology building, the big tall meteorology building with the dishes on top. Mm-hmm. And then toward the end, I was there 14 years, and about probably the last 4 years, we were out in the Wharf building. We moved to the Wharf building. Hmm. But it was just exciting. And I guess the reason I enjoyed, it was kind of a life-changing experience. You know, I learned about all these cutting-edge things happening in the climate, in the science, in the world. You know, we talked about climate warming back then. You know, now it's just getting popular sway, but I was reading reports and hearing lectures and talking. And then Reed Bryson had this habit of, he'd have a lot of guests, international guests, you know, and Gaylord Nelson would come and visit, and Proxmire would come and visit, and the head of the Canadian Grain Board, and the head of OAPEC, the Organization for Oil Exporting Countries, would come. And Reed would take him out to lunch. And we'd always go down to that burger place on Regent Street. Well, I'd always get invited to come along. So I started gaining a lot of weight. That was the first problem. But I just got to meet all these neat people on a kind of a you know, one-on-one basis. It was very exciting for me as a little kid from Wisconsin, you know. And as far as the work, personnel, payroll, all that, that was just work. What charged my imagination was the science that was going on. Mm-hmm. We were administering the Marine Studies Center at that time, and, you know, they had a boat out of Milwaukee, and so there was all the lake trout work. We worked closely with Sea Grant, and so I was involved in a lot of those things, and we had the Center for Climatic Research, which John Kutzbach was the director of, and doing really world-class science. He just recently got elected to the National Academy of Sciences, so that tells you the quality of his work.
Right.
And he was the nicest man, and we had kind of a, he grew up in Reedsburg, Wisconsin, and he knew my mother. And so we kind of had this little connection. And anyway, it was just very exciting. And then, but again, things get old. 14 years later, I had done everything. I had hired good staff that were doing a lot of things, and I had an opportunity to be an assistant dean in the School of Education. It was an open job. A man I knew, Sam Falsey, had been there for many years, and he retired. And, you know, these jobs as kind of the second level in a dean's office don't come up very often. You know, people tend to get them. Like, look at Frank Kustra. He's got a job. He's been there forever. And that was true of a lot of people. Bob Dye out in engineering, he's been there for a long time. So when you're an administrator, that's kind of what you aspire to, you know. And so anyway, I thought, well, this is a good opportunity, and I really like John Palmer. Wonderful. Again, a farming background. We talk farms and crops and all that kind of stuff. He was a great guy. Very grounded, very realistic man. And so then in 1984, that's when I went to the School of Education. And I think I did well there, too. They seemed to honor my work and so forth, and promoted me to associate dean.
And what were your responsibilities there?
Well, there I was the for administration, which involved all the grants and contracts and the trust funds and all the budgeting. That was really, and I was the financial advisor to the dean. And then, of course, there were all the payroll and personnel items. I was mainly classified personnel, but I processed the paperwork for the academic. And I had done some of that, but then Ann Wallace quit being the assistant to the dean and became kind of the personnel director, academic personnel director for the mm-hmm. School of Education. So some of that load was removed. I mean, this was too big a job for one person. Mm-hmm. When I retired, even, you know, they hired two people to fill the job. And it just, there were so many things that needed to be done, and you couldn't do them all the time. You were doing triage, doing what had to be done. And of course, I thought my most important job was, well, number one, getting the payroll out, but I had pretty good staff to do that. Was being the advisor to the dean. When the dean had a financial matter, or we had a budget cut, or, you know, there were things happening all the time. Graduate student remissions being in and then being out, and budget cuts, and then all of these things that Bascom would promulgate on us, you know, do this and cut here, and we'll give you one faculty position if you can justify it. All this stuff. It was just, you never knew what was going to happen.
When did you see that changing? I mean, did you see that there was a, when you first started doing budget work primarily on campus, did it gradually change, become more complex? Did it happen overnight?
No, I would say that budget work was fairly straightforward maybe the first 10 years I worked, so that would be till like 72. But after that, it just really, you never knew what was coming. I felt we were much more, and a lot of it was the legislature. Some of it were administrators on the campus that would have a little bee in their bonnet. I remember one year we went through a zero-based budgeting exercise. And this was just so foolish and required so much effort for no payoff. But it was somebody's thing, and I don't want to blame anyone for it. I think it was Don Percy, but I'm just not positive about that. And you never knew what was going to be handed to you. I mean, some years we would have a very straightforward merit pay exercise. Some years we'd have a merit pay exercise that required a raise three different times in a year. You know, October 1st, January 1st, and June 6th. And these were all just to save money. So the legislature could say, well, we've granted a 5% increase, but the 5% didn't come until the 6th of June. So they only had to pay it for 24 days. It didn't cost them much. And then, of course, we went through all of the, which had budget implications, all of that Hayes-Hale stuff. Everyone got retitled, which required new, and then the pay ranges. It used, you know, it was that if you hired a specialist, the professor could say, well, I think I want to pay him $22,000, and we'd pay him $22,000. Well, after Hayes-Hale, we had pay ranges and all the bit. And I'm not saying it was bad, but it was just very complex, mm-hmm. trying to move the campus away from this freedom to do as they chose. Because it was true, some of the sciences had a glut of people looking for work, and they would work very cheaply. So the professor wondered why he should pay $30,000 for a job that he could pay $22,000, you know. And of course, Hayes-Hale took all of that away, that discretion. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter what field you were in, and, you know. And the budget implications of trying to pay for $8,000 raises for people to fit them into these new ranges and things was a challenge.
What's it like being an administrator working with faculty?
Well, generally pretty good, I'd say. Faculty, once in a while I would run into a faculty member who would, you'd know, didn't think much of any academic staff member. You know, you weren't a colleague, let's put it that way. You were a subservient servant once in a while. And you, those were, you just knew how to work with them. You were very polite and yes sir, no sir, and did, you know. That's one of the things I always have believed that I'm a very straightforward person. I've kind of told people like it was. And in some ways, that was, my value to deans and directors, because I told them the facts. I didn't tell them what to do, but I laid out the case for them. And they could trust me to do that. And I didn't, you know, fish around or anything. But I also think I got pretty good at, you might say, handling somebody's faculty. I mean, some of them, they'd walk in your office and just by the thing. I always remember one guy, I joined the School of Education, and I met someone in the back hall. He was a very distinguished professor, and I was introduced to him. And he said, oh, how quaint, a female business manager. I that to me was kind of the ultimate put down. How quaint, a female business, and the tone of voice he used. And he was just that kind of guy. But I could work with him, you know, that was the way it was. You just had to work with him differentially.
What was the most challenging part of your position in the School of Education?
Challenging. Well, number one, I think getting some of the work done. There was way too much to do. Mm-hmm. Worked long, long hours. And was rushed. And now when I look back on it, I regret some of it. Because, you know, it would have been fun to enjoy it more. Mm-hmm. I just worked so hard. But the challenges, personnel was never easy for me. And I had some, you know, when you have to let people go or deal with the union grievances, some of them were just so off the wall. And yet, I always said that my greatest wish for my career was to retire and never have a big scandal. And that meant either don't have fraud on your watch, which could happen, you know. Or don't have some union rep accuse you of sexual harassment or something, you know. It's funny, but we used to joke about that. That was our big hope, that we could make it through without having that happen. And I did it. I got out of it without having that happen.
What was the culture of the School of Education? Did you work for more than one dean?
Oh, yes. I worked John Palmer and then Henry Chueba, who was an outsider and had a lot of troubles because of that. Mm. The School of Education just wasn't very accepting of an outsider. And, I mean, there were probably other problems, too. But. And then Mike Sokoviak and then Chuck Reed. I think there were four.
Did the culture change when new deans came in?
I'm not sure the culture changed. The way I worked with them had to change. Each one was different. John Palmer was a hands-on guy, knew a lot more than I would ever know. Mm-hmm. All you could be was an assistant to him. Henry Treva really leaned on me a lot because he didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. Came here without knowing budget, didn't know personnel rules, didn't know anything. And we built up a good trust. I enjoyed working with him, although we had a terrible time in the School of Education. Mm-hmm. The faculty really chewed him up. And so we were speaking of
the deans
and the cultures and so forth. And I think the School of Education was pretty, I don't want to use the word moribund, but I mean it had a tradition. And I didn't see that tradition change very much over the years I was there, 84 to 2016 years. But there were a lot of adjustments, you know, a lot of budget cuts we had to do, and some areas kind of died and some flourished and that kind of thing. But we had a very strong faculty, and the departments that were strong were still strong. There wasn't a lot of waxing and waning. And
the school has a great reputation nationally. Isn't it always ranked right at the top or near the top?
It is, yes. And a lot of that ranking is due to, you know, the research the faculty are doing. A lot of it is due to the, you know, we had a very successful Wisconsin Center for Education Research. Andy Porter headed it up. It was started by Herb Klausmeier, and then who was a national reputation man, good guy. And then Andy Porter came in and was gifted at getting money. And, you know, we had millions of dollars of education research. And then all those publications are out there, and all those grad students are out there. And so, yeah, the school really, it always kind of, I think, struggled with the preparation of teachers part. Mm-hmm. Because, for one thing, DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, was going through upheavals. Lots of new rules, new requirements, and lots of tension about, you know, telling us what kind of courses to teach. And our faculty felt they knew how to prepare a teacher and they didn't need DPI telling them, and there were always these mediations. Yeah. And Jack Keane, who was a professor of curriculum instruction, I think spent full time trying to be the interface between DPI and the School of Ed. Yeah. And the teachers, I mean, I think our teachers are well prepared. They certainly had no trouble getting work and were very, very well prepared. But there's always that tension, I think, between research. We were gangbusters. There were always some problem departments that, you know, had faculty that just could not get along with one another. They were just in a turmoil all the time. And a lot of it was just related to specific personalities. And there's not a lot you can do about some of that.
Were there challenges working with campus administration? Not only, I would say, in your education position, but in your other positions. Well, you were campus administration, really.
Well,
when you were.
No, we always. There was always, you know, the head offices, the central offices, the Peterson Building, and challenges. No, it was. I don't know what to say really. It was always hard. It wasn't easy, and some of our offices. Like working with the budget office was just a dream. Glenn Watts was head, and then John Torfey. Both smart, intelligent men who somehow could empathize with what was going on at the dean's level. Once in a while, you'd run into some unit that had somebody who didn't empathize very well. And they would make a demand and they'd want it, you know, or you'd tell them why you couldn't do this and really didn't listen. There was always that kind of thing. But that's true of every job. I mean, you had to somehow get around it. I think my particular position and the positions of people like me is particularly tough. But maybe that's just my myopia. But not only were we trying to be an assistant to a top administrator like a dean, we were also satisfying the needs of these top administrators like budget, personnel, payroll, institutional, accounting. Mm-hmm. Then we were also satisfying all the departments, which I don't say were beneath us, but I mean in the structure, in the hierarchy, they sent their paperwork up through us. Mm-hmm. And so you were kind of caught in the middle. These people require the higher administrators, these are the rules. This is what you need to do to get a travel advance at this university. These are the guys who didn't want to do it that way, or they had a reason why it shouldn't be that way. So you were always mediating. And no matter what you did, you weren't very popular. Because nobody ever remembered all the 50 times that you helped them or that their paperwork went through smoothly. What they remembered was the one time it didn't. So early on in this game, I made up my mind that I couldn't be too hung up on being popular, because you just weren't going to be. And the problems that came to my desk were the ones that my staff couldn't deal with. So I got these toughies that they'd probably already been alienated by the time that got to me. There wasn't a lot you could do except try to solve the problem in the best. And I always tried to be conscious of being an administrator that was administering the public's money.
And now, I know you were popular, though, with other people having the same response or like responsibilities that you had. You were considered a resource person on campus. Now, did you welcome that?
Yes, I enjoyed that. That was fun. That was kind of outside of my day-to-day duties. And I loved my committee work. And fortunately, my dean was always very supportive of letting me, because I'd spend maybe 4 hours a week working on campus committees.
Talk about some of those.
Well, some of them were just little ad hoc committees and budget and so forth. And my really big effort was kind of meshing the computerization with personnel and payroll. And way back in the 70s, I was on committees with George Everson and Glenn Watts and Jack Dewey, who was the computer man at the time, and Dick Laufenberg, and, you know, we'd sit around and try to map out the flow from hire to pay, you know, what administrative procedures had to be done, and we were trying to computerize it. And, of course, it was a long kind of fruitless thing, but bit by bit we'd make it, and I always seemed to get on those committees. And my last big effort was the IADS committee, which is the interactive data system for personnel. And we met for 2 years and eventually developed a system which now has resulted in IADS, which is the system that I think they just spent $26 million trying to replace. And now we're back to IADS again. So IADS goes on. Anyway, I thought it was a very good system, and I think I had a unique talent to kind of empathize with the department secretary who had to come up with stuff, the dean's needs, and maybe had some knowledge of administration's needs, you know. And so the payroll guy would talk about something, and then I'd say, well, but that's going to be hard for the department secretary or the typist to come up with, you know. And so this is how we talked, and I enjoyed that, and I think I was a resource for that. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's the other thing about being a resource. If you're an old enough dog and have been around long enough and remember things reasonably well, you end up having some sort of
library in your head that can be accessed. And I was there certainly long enough.
Would you talk about the climate for women on the Madison campus? Did it help you or hinder you in participation on campus activities or in your positions?
Well, I think I was very fortunate. I was hired by Ruben Moretz, who I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And I believe that he was one of only a few that really was seeking, actively seeking, women employees. It was a hard thing. And when I was hired, I mentioned I was the only woman until they hired Marita. Then there were two of us in the entire business office at a professional level. I mean, there were lots of typists, lots of, you know, those kind of payroll clerks and things like that. But someone who you had to have a degree to get a job, that was, there were the two of us. And it was a climate of, the men looked at us askance, sort of, I would say, but not too much hostility. I remember having several challenges early on with men wanting to get close to you in the elevator, you know, and you had to back them away. And we had one particular guy who kept, every time we'd get in a room with him, he'd have a particularly onerous, dirty joke to tell you. So you had to somehow get him off the track. These were little challenges for me as a young girl, you know. But I think that's maybe true of all life. But little things, like there was a what they call BA, Business Administrators Association. And everybody in the Peterson Building area, personnel, payroll, all belonged to this, the men. The typists weren't welcome. But if you were a, you know, budget or a purchasing agent or any of that, and they'd have Christmas parties and they had monthly meetings that would have speakers, a little bit like Roundtable is now, but it was just limited to the administrators of the Peterson Building area. Well, of course, no women could come. Well, here I was a professional woman, so I used to kind of rag on them a little bit, you know, just jolly. And finally, Phil Hellmuth was president one year, and I don't remember what year this was. It was probably early on. We were already in the Peterson Building. We had moved, maybe 67, 68. And Phil said, you know, he said, I'm willing to try it if you are. You want to come to our next meeting? So I came to the next meeting. I was alone in this sea of men. And they all looked at me, and of course I had known some of them because I worked with them, and everyone was very cordial. The next meeting, he invited Marita. So Marita came, and we went from there. That was the integration of the BA. And I always remember going to the university club a couple times and being asked to go in the side door. You couldn't come up the front steps and go into that front room when you're a woman. You had to go around the side and come in, you know, where the ladies' restroom and coat room and dressing room is. And so there were those kinds of little things. Mm-hmm. But I never had much trouble personally. And I, once administratively, once in a while you'd run into a faculty member who you could see just didn't want to hire a woman, but the dean was always pretty sensitive to that, the deans and directors. In IES, which was my 14 years in the middle there, I think women were accorded equal or greater prestige. There seemed to be an acceptance of women there that was just wonderful. You know, we had a lot of professional women, Susan Flater, and Estella Leopold was there a while, and look at Gretchen Shaw, and really strong women who contributed a great deal were very key and instrumental there. So, as I say, I think I was blessed, very fortunate. I really didn't have a lot of impact. The only thing I do think that probably I didn't get the directorship of research again, somewhat because they weren't prepared to have a woman do that. Mm-hmm. But I'm prepared, also willing to admit that it might have been I didn't quite have the skill set that they thought they needed either. But, you know, it was a little bit of both in there.
Sure.
So, but it was very interesting.
Now, did you belong to any professional organizations?
Yes, I belong to the National Council of University Research Administrators, which was associated with my grants administration work. And that too was, again, do you remember Bob Gentry? He was also an assistant vice president. He worked with Ruben Lorenz and Neil Caffrey. Well, Bob Gentry, for some reason, took kind of a liking to me. Again, maybe because I was the only little young woman in the business office. But he was very supportive and he came to me one day and he said, you know, he said, I'd like you to come to Washington at our conference this fall. He said, I think you should come to the Incura meetings and be a member, because we need somebody. Research admin should be represented. So I dutifully signed up and they paid my way. I went to Washington. We went to the Mayflower Hotel. And Incura at that time was about a 300-member organization. It's now over 2,500 members. It's huge. But at that time, research administration was not really a profession. It was just something that maybe accountants did or personnel people gravitated into it, you know, or failed scientists or at different universities, you know, who knows who did it. Anyway, it was a very small group, and again, there were very few women. I remember going to this one banquet this first year, and Bob, of course, was very attentive and husband me, and I met so many nice people. I remember a man from the University of Illinois who just was so charmed that there was a research administrator who was a woman, you know. But we joked about the fact that you looked around the room, there were quite a few women in the room, but they were either spouses or they were nuns.
Oh my.
Because a lot of the Catholic schools, you know, would send a representative, and they were none. So we joked that, you know, I was the only non-spouse, non-nun person in the room. I don't think that was true. I'm sure there were some others. But it was, and then I usually went every year and was kind of a liaison and helped on some little subcommittees. I never really got sucked into the national politics, though. Now, Marita got much more involved. She was national treasurer and national committee chairman, and I stayed local.
Did you find, though, that being a part of that organization was important
job? It was fantastic, and I did what I could to get other people to go. And we eventually ended up that Wisconsin sent quite a contingent every year, even out in the colleges, you know, people started going. Mm-hmm. When I went, no one was going except Eric Rudy. Eric Rudy early on went because he had been in the National Science Foundation and he was in with kind of the organizers of it. But anyway, I thought it was just wonderful because I would go, I tended to work really hard and really passionately and deep and just got immersed. And it was like coming up out of a burial site or deep water, and you'd let everything go and you'd go to Washington. And then you'd sit there in your suit in these wonderful, beautiful built rooms in the Mayflower Hotel, which was a very charming old hotel. And you would sit next to all these other people who were just like you. And we'd start talking about an overhead problem or a human subjects problem. And then we had lots of little committees. You met people. I mean, I made so many contacts, and other people would call me, and I'd call them when we were back. But you came away from those meetings not only having learned something, but feeling like you really belonged to a profession. And that, you see, was missing on the campus. Mm-hmm. Someone in my position was just alone. There was no one else. Mm-hmm. Now, I had an unusual situation because Marita and I ended up living together. Mm-hmm. We were in an apartment of five people, and everybody got married except us. So we just, for monetary reasons, stayed together. You know, mm-hmm. It was cheap. And she also was in the same kind of job. So we could do a lot of talking about her problems and my problems, and we helped each other, I think, in mm-hmm. advice. But you were alone in your position, like you felt like a captain in a ship. Nobody eats with you, you know, you're just alone. And when you went to Washington, you weren't alone. And other people had the same problems. And in fact, I used to come back exhilarated because in almost every case, the problems that were discussed in Washington Wisconsin had already recognized and was well down the road to addressing. I'd come home feeling so proud of Wisconsin and proud of our work and proud of, well, we saw that coming. We didn't get blindsided like, you know, Cornell did or something. You know, it was just it took you outside of yourself. Then you'd come back, and in a month or so, you'd be back to the grind again. But I think it was very worthwhile, and it was money well spent by the university. Mm-hmm. So.
Now, you, when you retired, with emeritus status.
Yes.
Which is definitely quite an honor. Would you talk about other awards and honors that you've received over the years in your career?
Well, I haven't gotten too many. The School of Education gave me a Distinguished Service Award toward the end, which was very nice. There's a competition for it, and there's a committee, and people nominate, and I had some lovely letters, and people talked about my service and knowledge and all that stuff. And I was pleased to get, and I was especially pleased because my mother was still alive and she could come.
Oh, nice.
And I remember when I left the Institute for Environmental Studies, one of the men I was working with was an aide in the governor's office at that time, Tony Earle's office. And they declared a day that was Dorothy Klinefelter Day. I got this little thing,
oh,
you know, that for your distinguished service to the institute and the school and the state and all that. And I got it signed by Tony Earle. So that's my little...
That's impressive.
That's my little thing. Well, they would do that for anybody, but it was...
It's the first I've heard of it.
It was kind of cute. And, but, you know, the fact of the matter is that in the administrative world at the university, there aren't many awards. Now, in the last few years, they've come up with a few more. There's these $1,000 awards where you can be nominated, which I think is so wonderful. And even in, like, the school I was in, School of Education, has now got a couple awards even for classified people. Mm-hmm. See, part of my career, I was classified. I was classified until probably the mid-70s.
And then were you just switched over to academic staff, or did you move into a job?
No, I was switched over.
Okay.
Because I met the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a boss who was willing to do the paperwork and do it. You know, I mean, I did the paperwork, but he was willing to do it.
Okay.
Because almost everybody who was administrative was classified in those mm-hmm. days. Mm-hmm. So, and now we've kind of gone back to that. A lot of administrators are being forced to go back into classifying. But the titles have been broadened and the salary ranges have been broadened.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time there when you were an accountant four, there was no place to go in the classified service. You were it. That was it. So if you were going to get additional duties and be more valuable, you had to go to academic.
Sure.
So, but I have to say that, you know, I always felt valued and I always felt honored in some regard. You know, my deans were always very, very... complimentary and so forth. So it was a good career, I think. Enjoyed it.
The last set of questions have to do with your life after work, your retirement, and also what you did when you were working, what you did for fun and relaxation. What are you doing now in retirement? How do you keep yourself healthy?
Well, remember when we started out, I told you that I wanted to be a forester or a wildlife ecologist. That's kind of the theme that has gone through my life, I think. And maybe that's why I enjoyed Institute for Environmental Studies so much. Mm-hmm. Meeting, going to the shack and seeing Aldo Leopold's place and meeting some of these great I met David Brower, mm-hmm. the great Sierra Club director, mm-hmm. you know. Oh, man, that was a thrill. Anyway, my life... I was very fond of my mother and dad, and they retired in the 60s, and they moved up near Linden Station. They have a little 60-acre farm, had a little 60-acre farm up there. And I would many weekends retreat to my folks' house, and we did things together. I'd help them. They'd come down here, help us. So many things around our house. You know, walls were painted. Dad would fix this. They just loved it when we bought this house,
uh-huh.
and they helped us. And we just had a really great... They loved Marita, and we would go down to Chicago to visit with her folks, and we were very family oriented. And we were very fortunate. I think I was so fortunate to have made some wonderful friends. And some of that, I think, came with being poor, because we lived in an apartment with five people, and you got to know all of them, and you got to know all their circle friends. And we learned to ski together, so we had skiing weekends, and in the summer we'd water ski, and we hiked every place in the state, and bird watched, and all of our friends seemed to also appreciate nature. I think nature was kind of a theme. And now, since I've always read a lot. Every night I read before I go to bed.
What do you like to read?
Oh, I love to read to learn. I read nonfiction, I guess. Mm-hmm. I love biographies, history, biology. I read everything published practically about nature, and I love nature writers. Mm-hmm. And my appetite is bigger than my ability to absorb, however. I have probably hundreds of books that I have purchased but have not yet completed.
So many books, so little time.
That's right, exactly. But I do love to read. And like now I'm reading Fiasco, which is the one about Iraq that's out. That's just fascinating. I can't put it down. And finished reading the one about the Pilgrims, the Puritans. Nathaniel somebody. I can't remember the name now.
Do you travel?
And then I've traveled. Mm-hmm. Marita did a lot of traveling with her job. And often, like, she'd go to a convention, the grad school would send her out to Seattle. Well, I'd go along and rent a car and go off and see Seattle while she was in meetings. So we did a fair amount of that. And then we did a lot of camping in our early years. So we'd go out to Yellowstone and the Tetons and Grand Canyon, and always to nature places.
Uh-huh.
And we went to Africa one time, which was really a great trip, and I've been down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon four times. I just love that. So you get the theme here. I love wild nature. Yeah. And since we've retired, I think I'd say the theme is wildlife, because we went to visit the polar bears in Churchill, and then we went to see the wolves in the winter in Yellowstone. That was just a magical week, watching the wolves down in the valley and seeing them. They didn't know we were, or they knew we were there, but we didn't impact. We were just, what I like, I don't like wildlife that's up close and personal. I like looking in on their world. Mm-hmm. And it's just really nice. And then last year we went to British Columbia and watched grizzly bears fish for salmon along the rivers. We would be in a boat offshore, about 30 feet away, and the bear would be on the sandbar. It was just wonderful. And we've run into a really wonderful group of people. It's through the Alumni Association. There are 14 of us. And Kit Nordine is one of them, and Helen Iltis is another from Madison. Mm-hmm. And we've just all gotten along so well, and we've all been on all four of those trips. And next summer we're going to Newfoundland.
And those are all alumni trips?
They're all alumni trips. So, and I guess we're the first alumni group that has ever, intact as a group, stayed together for four trips. So it's kind of, and we just got along very well, and it's fun. And, of course, Mari and I love to bird. We went over to visit my brother just now, and we made an extra day, and we visit the Saney Wildlife Refuge, and we saw trumpeter swans. Mm. I couldn't think of the name. We're going to see the whooping cranes up later in December. I kept thinking that. And we've gone to Florida to look at birds. We went to the Chiricahua Mountains 2 years ago in Arizona, southern Arizona. Mm-hmm. We saw 110 species in 1 week. It was a great, great week of birding. And I'm not the kind of birder that, needs to keep a list or anything like that. And I just love seeing creatures in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. See them be. And my mom and dad have both passed away, and I retained the farm. I was able to do that.
That's nice.
And so I've still got this 64 acres up near Linden Station with a nice little house and a barn on it, and it's kind of a pain to maintain it, but I love going up there. The turkeys strut around, you know, and we've got some sandhill cranes on the place, and the hawks are there, and we're going to go up tomorrow night and try to see the Perseid meteor shower. So that's where my inspiration comes, is nature.
Sure.
And we spent 3 weeks in Hawaii this year with friends. We have a little bridge club, 8 of us. And all 8 of us went to Hawaii. And we spent 3 weeks there. And it was wonderful. We all got along great. It was a really special trip. So I've been blessed with wonderful friends.
Yeah. It sounds like a wonderful life. Wonderful life.
Yeah.
Well, there are no more questions. Is there anything you'd like to add to the tape before we stop?
I feel like I've done a complete dump of my life here.
Well, that was the point.
Yes. I don't know. I've always been grateful to have come to the University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a dream. I was going to go to Colorado. I was going to, you know, go to some city. What a mistake that would have been. This has been so nice because I really enjoy Madison. The people here, I like living here, mm-hmm. and especially the people.
Yeah.
Like my work. Now, I have to say that when I left work, I think a lot of people thought I would not be happy because I was so involved in work and so intense, because I know I was intense, too intense. I wish I had had a little more fun going around in work. But anyway, but when I left work, it was just like it dropped off my radar screen. And I have to say, retirement has just been, you know, an image of where a glacier or ice is out over the land, and then when the glacier melts, the land bounds up, you know. Well, that's the way I feel. The glacier got lifted off my back, and I now am, I get up in the morning and I can do what I want. Of course, there's plenty of stuff you have to do. Trips to the doctor and the dentist and all that stuff. But it's just really wonderful. I can sit and read a book in the afternoon. I've never done it before. And we can go see a movie when it comes. And we spend a lot of time with family. Marita has a sister and a brother out west, and my brother in Michigan. And I have two nieces, and so I've just spent a lot of time with them, a lot of time with friends. Gone on quality times to Florida, and anyway, it's great. It's wonderful. And I miss some of my friends, because that's part of what I really loved about the university, was the constant learning. I did so much love the accounting. I didn't so much love the business, you know, that kind of stuff. What I loved was learning something new every day about science or whatever, being on the cutting edge. You learned it before anybody else, in meeting some of the most interesting people. One day I was sitting in my office, and Lili Ji, who is a professor of kinesiology, came in, and we just got chatting. He was walking a grant through, and he started talking, and he started telling me about his time. He is from China, mainland China, and he was one of the young teenage boys who got lifted away from his family and sent out to Mongolia in the great cleansing of the intellectuals, you know. Mm-hmm. And he ended up running a pig farm. And he was responsible for 1,000 souls. And he had to raise the pigs. Mm-hmm. And he did this for about 4 or 5 years before this time was over and they could go back to the cities and he could resume his education. Now he's here at the University of Wisconsin. And, I mean, he had many details and many stories. It was just great, you know. That was the kind of thing that made me keep going to work. I just loved meeting those kinds of people. Mm-hmm. And things I would never do, but I was able to have a window on that world.
Sure, sure.
So I miss that, but I also do a lot of reading and keep in touch with some people. And the School of Education has been very nice about inviting me back. For alumni events and things like that, so mm-hmm. I've been able to keep seeing some of these people. Although now when you go back, I've never been one to go back to my office much. But you also go into the dean's office and you don't recognize anybody anymore. You know, it doesn't take long for everything sure. to turn over.
Right.
And I certainly don't want to be one of those retirees who hangs around, you know, because that's hard. I mean, I had to deal with some of that. Old retirees would come in and you always liked them a lot and so forth, but they took time I didn't have to give, you know, at the time. So I really did just drop out of the university. Mm-hmm. But it's been wonderful.
Still go to football games, though.
I go to football games, and I'm still interested in what goes on. I read the paper, and I get invited to retirement parties and try to go. One of my employees was honored a year ago by the School of Ed. I tried to get to that. But some of it is limited by the fact of whether I get told about it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I wish there was a better way that someone like me who leaves could stay hooked in, you know, mm-hmm. It's difficult. You mm-hmm. do just kind of drop out.
Yeah.
So, and as the people you knew and could call up retire, there's no one to take to lunch and learn about what's going on either. So you have to kind of keep going. But all in all, it's been very good. I've been very blessed.
Well, this was an excellent interview. Great stories.
Really?
Thank you. Yes, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. It's been an honor to have you come.